Hey, this is Larry Stewart of the group Restless Heart, and you're listening to Neon Eon.
Hey everyone, I'm Thomas Mooney, and welcome back to the Neon Eon, where we talk about country music from the late 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. This week, we're taking it back, a little bit further back than we have on previous episodes. Most, if not all, of the previous Neon Eon guests, they essentially get started or established in the late 80s. The ball starts rolling for them around that time. With Restless Heart, their story starts just a little bit earlier in the decade. They formed in 1984, they released that debut self-titled in 85, which, don't get me wrong, it's a solid record, but they really just rocket up the charts with their next album, Wheels, in 86. They end up racking up 4 number one hits off that album, with the songs Wheels, Why Does It Have to Be Wrong or Right, I'll Still Be Loving You, and That Rock Won't Roll. They end up having a few other massive hits that carry on into the early to mid-90s as well. I often talk about the wide range of styles that were on the radio at the time and these pockets and regionalism that's happening during this era of country music. I think it's primarily focused on those neo-traditionalists like George Strait and Clint Black and Reba McEntire, or like the rockabilly of Marty Stewart, Dwight Yoakam and the Bakersfield Sound Renaissance, actual cowboy country with Chris LeDoux, the singer-songwriters who you know have these coffee shop folk backgrounds like David Ball and Mary Chapin Carpenter, Appalachia and the Kentucky Headhunters and Patti Loveless, and y'all are probably picking up what I'm throwing down here by now. But one of these pockets that we've not really talked about as much is with bands like Restless Heart. Little Texas is in the same ballpark, Lone Star, post John Rich, some of the Alabama, maybe some era-specific Eddie Rabbit, Steve Warner, Exile, Southern Pacific, two of my all-time favorites with Earl Thomas Conley and Dan Seals. But again, y'all probably get the point by now. All of these artists, while country, they usually tap into that softer side of country. Definitely less twang. They're going off like a Kenny Rogers or a Conway Twitty playbook, and not so much of the Waylon playbook. Well, at least not the 70s version of Waylon, because there's definitely some disco rhythms in some of that 80s Waylon. But that's an entirely different podcast altogether. They mix in these 80s rock and pop aspects that at times make you feel like they could have gone on tour with someone like Journey or Huey Lewis and the News, which I'm just going to say right now, a Huey Lewis and the News and Restless Heart tour, that would have just been amazing. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is that this too is an essential part of the Neon Eon. It's less cowboy hats and less cowboy boots, and more ball caps and sneakers. Which, as I mentioned earlier, plenty of merit goes to the Restless Heart catalog and career as a whole. They had a massive amount of hits. Their songs had substance, mass appeal, and just infectious melodies. But they're also pioneers in a way because, well, whether you like it or not, country music becomes a global market in the 90s, and they really helped lay a lot of that foundation. Before we get started though, a handful of housekeeping notes. One, this sounds pretty obvious, super easy. If you're new here, go ahead and subscribe. It's kind of like y'all deciding the Neon Eon should be one of your radio presets. Maybe in time this all lands me a Sirius XM Prime Country gig. And hell, I'll even make them a great deal on buying the name. If you're listening on iTunes, go ahead and leave a 5-star review. I believe we're at 16 for 16 on the reviews right now being 5-star. Let's try and hit that 25 mark by next week. That isn't too much to ask, is it? Be sure to check out the Patreon. Shout out to the handful of Patreon subscribers that came in this past week as well. If you're unfamiliar with Patreon, it's a great way to help support the podcast and get added features like Neon Eon merch, bonus content during these interviews, and ad-free interviews. And speaking of merch, some new shirt designs are coming in really, really soon. Those will be a lot of fun. Probably going to get some era-specific koozies done as well. I'm talking about like those thick foam ones that aren't collapsible. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go through your mom and dad's photos from college. You'll most definitely see one. Your dad will probably be rocking a mullet and like a Tim McGraw mustache and a bright brush popper pearl snap. And your mom, she'll probably be rocking one of those denim vests. hopefully more like Shania Twain and less like Travis Tritt. Maybe some of those pocketless Rockies. But yeah, trust me, if they're anything like my parents, you'll see this like thick foam koozie holding a Coors Yellow Belly. Again, all of that, it'll be coming really soon. If you like hearing me ramble on with songwriters and artists, you should definitely check out my other podcast that focuses on Americana. It's called New Slang. I've had folks like Culture Wall, Ben Nichols of Lucero, Jamie Wyatt, Kelsey Walden, and literally another 155 episodes worth. Again, it's called New Slang, and it's out Mondays and Thursdays. Last but not least, I do have a couple of Neon Eon playlists for y'all. One is basically every top 10 hit from January 1st, 1990 to December 31st, 1999. It's over 900 songs long. And the other one, I'm calling it the Songwriters. So it's all those hits performed by the original songwriter. I'm always adding to it, but examples are like Gretchen Peters performing Independence Day, Jim Lauderdale doing Where the Sidewalk Ends, Skip Ewing doing Love Me, and Tony Lane doing Letters from Home. And links to all of the stuff that I just mentioned, plus Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, those will all be in the show notes. All right, let's do it. Here is Larry Stewart of Restless Heart. Start out with you today is, you know, let's take it back to like when the band started forming, and you know, this is like that mid 80s era, and I guess like from my understanding is like the band was kind of started as you guys were all in this form of time where you guys were doing demos and like cutting songs and stuff like that in the studio setting. And then like out of this, you guys formed and then soon started making your own records. Is that right?
It really is. Although there was just a couple of guys doing studio work, Dave, our keyboard player, and Greg, our guitar player. I was doing some studio work though as well, doing jingles. You know, actually, I would fly up to Chicago about once every 2 weeks and you know, sing Take It to My Haters, boom, boom, you know. and then they'd send me home. You know, it was that simple. Back in the golden era of TV and radio and you know, and music was different back then, and just the way we made music a part of our life back then. There wasn't a lot of bands in the mid 80s. We all moved to Nashville and trying to get our heads, you know, wrapped up in what we were going to do with our careers. And a bunch of Oklahoma guys got together, and along with our producers, Tim DuBois and Scott Hendricks, called them the Oklahoma Music Mafia. And we got started. They got started, you know, early 80s together, doing some things, doing some recording. And they needed a lead singer. And I had met Dave at Belmont University, met Greg around town at some, you know, live venues, and worked with them a little bit in the studio. But yeah, it was really a vision of Tim DuBois, to be honest with you. And, you know, the band era of country music was just taking off. You know, right on the heels of Alabama just kicking the door down. Now, yeah, Exile had, you know, they were out there. But, you know, the country music band just hadn't caught on yet. And then Randy Owen and the boys just knocked it out of the park from early on. And so we were on the same label, RCA, and Joe Galani signed us after watching us in a, you know, do a like a showcase. And it was really, you want to talk about different times. I mean, those are fun times on Music Row. The energy was bouncing back and forth from house to house to office to studio to studio down Music Row, 16th and 17th Avenue. And then, you know, you could just feel something happening in country music. And you know, because everything up to then, except, you know, if it was a crossover, Glenn Campbell and Kenny Rogers, you know, maybe Dolly, you know, it was just beginning, you know, to move out of small performing arts centers into arenas. And we put our, we went in and recorded our album literally 1984 in April. We did a showcase in the summer. We signed in September and released our first single, Let the Heartache Ride, in January of 85. It happened that fast. I mean, that never happens. I mean, we just kind of backed right into it. The timing was right, and they were ready to go. We had never played a live show together in our lives. Everything we had done was in the studio. So we went into rehearsal and started putting a show together, our very first show in front of a live crowd. Was a sold-out arena opening up for Alabama in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And that started us going on the road with Alabama for the next year, maybe year and a half. But that was really literally the beginning of Restless Heart, and it just doesn't happen that way anymore. It doesn't happen that fast. To be honest with you, it just seemed too easy at the time in that era. You know, if you could get on a major label, you were going to have an opportunity to have hits and let the listeners, let the country music fans out there make the decision if they bought in or not, if they liked you or not, if they wanted to hear your songs or come see you live. It's not that easy anymore. But that's kind of where we were. And, you know, we, as I ramble, we were right at the bottom of the big country music swell. I mean, there were only a handful of gold and platinum albums on the Billboard charts at the time. And so we saw Alabama take it to the next level. The next artist we got to open for was Hank Williams Jr. We got to see him take off in the arena era. And then we, you know, started touring with Reba. She took off in the arena. So we got in that mid to late 80s, got to watch the whole country music business ramp up and be bigger than it's ever been. And so we got to ride that wave through the late 80s, and through the 90s, and then Vince Gill takes off, and, you know, we tour with him. So Restless Heart's career is a lot different than a lot of them out there, and we just happened to hit it just at the right time when country music was cocked and ready to go and explode throughout the United States of America, and we just got lucky and got to be a part of it.
Yeah, like that's one of those things where I think a lot of younger people, it's hard to wrap their head around the idea that country music was a lot smaller back then. It wasn't as, like, as you say, like, it wasn't in these arenas, you know, it wasn't like in that setting. It was smaller, and there wasn't as many giant, you know, platinum records and gold records. And at this point right here is like whenever all of that, all the right things were happening as far as the sound, the artists, like the charisma behind the artists, right? And like music became a little bit more portable with the cassette and the CD. All these little things like happened at the right time, and you did see this explosion. As you put it right there, you know, I feel like everyone, you know, at the end of the day is probably paying their dues to get to a point where they are able to have some success. But as you said right there, you know, it was a very, very fast process of getting kind of put together, cutting some songs, getting signed, and then like, boom, you're on this like tour with Alabama. at that point right there, where you just, was it one of those things where you guys kind of just look at each other and go, oh man, yeah, this is actually happening. This is a, you know, this isn't a dream.
We were kind of lost, to be honest with you, because it happened so fast. We didn't really know what we were doing. We just went in the studio and made records with the songs that we had, with a few songs that we had written. Tim Dubois had written some songs that actually Alabama turned down. We recorded them. You know, that's the true story. And it just, I don't really know, you know, how we happened to get on that, really that beginning of that big country band push. But it just, we just got lucky, got on the same label of Alabama. And then some of our other friends like Diamond Rio and, you know, and Sawyer Brown and some of those guys, here they came. And, you know, it was just became a great era of bands. And the funny thing about it is, you know, we got to watch the whole band era in country music happen. And we are now kind of watching the whole country music band era go away.
Right.
It's just not hardly any bands going on. The whole kind of, I don't know what to think about it. And I don't know why bands aren't continuing to do great things and make great music for radio anymore, but they just seem to kind of be fallen by the wayside. Now, what we have noticed that the 90s era, especially out on the road, has taken off over the last few years. You know, there is a demand for the 80s, late 80s and 90s music. And, you know, we're seeing the shows go up. We're seeing the money go up. We're just seeing an excitement. We're seeing the crowds get bigger. We're seeing these packages that they're putting together with bands. And people are loving it, you know, of all ages. So it's really been quite a phenomenon to watch, especially someone of my age and been around and watched the very beginning of it. And now I'm, you know, experiencing and watching and see how it unfolds now. And it's just kind of interesting.
Yeah. Like what I find really interesting too about like this quote unquote, like the band era is that, yeah, you are seeing less of the, less new bands and like, they're more like vocal duos or vocal groups and less of like a band thing, where I guess like the argument against the band, quote unquote, is like there's not the same focus on like as like a face, you know what I mean? As far as like there's a difference between Restless Heart and Clint Black. Like people just know who Clint Black is, where there's a little more anonymity with a band. But I feel like that would be like the same case for like a vocal group or something too. You could use that same argument, but like we're not applying those rules to vocal groups the same way you're doing it to a band.
Well, it's really funny because country music has dealt with bands and promoted bands, and it's just different than some of the rock bands and even the pop bands, you know, and back in the day, or the, you know, like the 70s rock bands, because lead singers seem to jump, you know, step out on their own. I forgot what I was going to say. They're really the only, a household word or a household name, I should say, as far as lead singer of a band, probably the only one would be Randy Owen. Mm-hmm. You know, and the rest of us are just really about the band and the music. Now, having said that, I guess that kind of just goes to show you how good the songs were and how, you know, the music really touched people's lives back that time, because we're seeing, again, an uptick in the interest of 90s music and 90s songs and 90s instrumentation and those voices. You know, back in those days in the late 80s, you knew every voice on the first four, you know, words they sang. You knew Reba as soon as she started. You knew Garth. You knew Vince. You knew Alan Jackson. You know, you knew Randy Owen. You knew Ricky Skaggs. I mean, these voices were all unique, along with some great songs, because the songwriting in Nashville, especially in that era, was the best. Was the best songwriting in the world. And so, yeah, it's just really interesting how that's all panned out, how it's still panning out. I mean, boy, there's some, you know, nowadays there's some great, you know, some great Lady A and, you know, a bunch of great vocal groups that just got great music out there. But it is, it's kind of taken away the full band aspect and gone back to just the trio or the quartet, you know, or the you know, like it used to be the Gatlins and the Oak Ridge Boys and the Statler Brothers and whoever. And now it's gone back to that, except more contemporary. And the bands are kind of being left out for now. Very interesting to me.
Yeah. Was there, I know, obviously, like you being like the lead singer, you probably had to do a lot of the interviews at the time. But was there a little bit, of comfort knowing that you didn't necessarily have like the same pressure as being like it being Larry Stewart and Restless Heart, and it was just like Restless Heart, a band? Was there a little bit more comfort knowing that there was like, you guys were all in it together and it wasn't just like hired guns?
There probably, to be honest with you, probably so. You know, because you know, most of everything we did, except for an interview, was, you know, we hit the stage together, we did television together, we did the award shows together. And so, you know, I grew up a big sports fan. As a matter of fact, I played college baseball for 3 years. I mean, I love sports. My favorite sports, of course, I'm a golfer. I love golf. But I grew up playing team sports. I always loved the team aspect of going about something. Just because it's always cool to play with or work with other people, especially other very talented people that can, you know, we can help each other raise our game, or we can win together or lose together or whatever. And, you know, that kind of translated over into my music career, because, you know, I came to Nashville and what did I do? I became a lead singer of a band or a team. And so you're right. I can, there is correlation there, you know, so psychologically you are going about it together.
Yeah. I wish I would have thought of that right there. Cause I knew you had got that athletic scholarship to Belmont, and like, just it would have been different if you were like a tennis player. Maybe you would have had like, you would have started out thinking you were going to be like your own artist the entire time. I want to go back to the demo singer aspect, because I feel like this is probably like such a short amount of time that you guys were doing this, but, was there, I'm sure there had to be something that you knew that was going to be a hit and that you guys cut a demo of, and just, you're like, oh man, I wish we had this. Is there any examples like that?
For me, you know, I never did, I never did do a song that went, wow, you know. I actually did the original vocal to God Bless the USA, because Lee Greenwood was on the road, and the producer, Jerry Creswell, asked me to come be the stunt singer for the band and orchestra to record it. So that's kind of a claim to fame, a song, I'd say. But as far as doing demos around, I don't really remember a song that I did that I demoed that became a huge hit. But there you have it. And as far as the other guys, I can't speak for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned Tim Dubois and like how, you know, early on, a lot of those songs were either co-writes with him or Van Stevenson, who would later become, you know, one of the principal members of Blackhawk. A lot of these songs back then were connected with him either as a co-writer or as a writer in general. I guess, like, do you remember like the first time you heard some of those early songs and like met Van, and as far as like just knowing like, oh, this is the guy behind some of these songs?
a bunch of us wrote for Warner Brothers Music, and Tim wrote for them, and Dave Robbins and Van Stevenson, as you say, wrote for them, and a bunch of other great writers. It was really a hotbed of great songwriters at the time there. So a lot of our songs came from there. So Van and Dave and Tim brought the Blue Skies in Texas. And I mean, we couldn't work in Texas hardly. They did not like our sound. It was too contemporary with the five-part harmony. You know, maybe it was the mullets. I don't know. But anyway, we could not work Texas at all until we released the Blue Skies in Texas. And, of course, ever since then, Texas has been a great, great friend of ours. But, we were getting pitch songs. You know, Tim was really going through all of that. We were all trying to write together. Dave Robbins and Steve Bogard and myself wrote I just had a title block on a song that I wrote. It's called Long Lost Friend. And so we wrote that around what Dave was going through at the time in his life with him and his wife. And you know, that's we would show up, you know, at the writers' rooms there at Warner Brothers and drink coffee and share a title or share an experience and then we'd write them. And, you know, that's just what you did back then. You go to Music Row and sit in a room with other writers and y'all try to write a good song. And so we were getting a lot of really good songs played for us, you know. And Tim being such a great song man and such a great songwriter himself, he got his hands on some great stuff. And obviously, because there's still songs that people still want to hear today.
Yeah. Like I want to touch on, like you were talking about, like the five-part harmony part real quick. That right there, obviously, like you guys just feel like you guys fit like hand in glove but I'm sure, was there like, what kind of like work had to go into getting all that right? Because it's not necessarily like where you guys just showed up and started singing perfectly together. Or was it that easy?
Yeah, no, it was painstaking there at the beginning, especially because we were trying to create a sound, you know, and Greg, you know, not everybody in the band were quote unquote singers, but had ears good enough to be able to sing parts. So the whole idea, Tim's vision was to, you know, have a band that really had strong harmonies. Well, as we sat around a piano and sat around guitars and learned some of those early songs and you know, put different guys' voices on certain parts, you know, well, you got a lower song, you got the high, you know, it was like almost meant to be. It was almost like God put us together and said, you know, it's kind of almost family. Everything worked so good. We had every timbre different. All five voices, though, had totally different timbres. I mean, no one even comes close to sounding alike. But you put those five voices together and you kind of put it in there and mush it all together in a bowl of stew and mix it to where, you know, those five voices rub together. It's just magical. And in the beginning, it was so hard to. I think we spent 24 hours on the chorus of Wheels to get all the vocals right on the first chorus. So that's what they ended up counting up on. You know, because back then it was 24-inch tape. Mm-hmm. There was no Pro Tools. Oh, we can fix that. You know, we'll tune that up. No, you had to sing every consonant and every note just right. So it took some time. As we went along and everybody got comfortable and we knew exactly what we were doing, it got a lot easier. But in the beginning, it was It was tough. We spent a lot of money back in those old days on major label budgets. Spent a lot of money getting those voices, those vocals right. So,
yeah, like it seems like it was, it's one of those things where you know you have these five puzzle pieces, and it was just trying to figure out how they all work together. And obviously, like whenever you hear any of these old songs, like usually around that first chorus, when all the voices come together, you just get hit and you're like, oh, this is what I signed up for whenever I put this song on, because when it works, it just is, it's, you know, it's chill inducing.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, you know, it's live that's so cool, because you stand in the, you know, being the lead singer, stand in the middle of the stage and hear the other four voices surrounding you and filling up the venue, you know, and you hear it all coming around you. And growing up, singing with my father's quartets and growing up with harmony, you know, it's pretty special to be able to hear those harmonies every night. And I got to tell you, I'm not bragging, because I'm just singing lead, but those guys around me singing all the harmonies, I mean, every night, just tight as a drum, just so much fun. And just, you know, just feel like it's something special that, you know, a team comes together and you're playing, you know, at your best. And if everybody has, you know, nobody's sick and everybody has their full voice, it's magical every night.
Yeah. You mentioned the, like that first show with Alabama and like that first run, of course, like you guys are a new band. And you mentioned just like having the live performance of that's what you loved as far as being on stage and hearing those voices surround you. What was it like, you know, like being in front of, you know, a crowd for the first time who never really heard you guys, did they pick up on those harmonies? Like, was that like the kind of the first thing that you guys look around and go, oh, they're getting this? Was that pretty early on?
Well, that's funny. That's a good question. Because early on, we felt like everybody's looking at us with deer in the headlights look. Because, you know, when we started in a very traditional time for country music. This was... Yeah, there was Kenny Rogers, and he was doing crossover. And then in the early days, there was, you know, Gatlin Brothers and Glenn Campbell and all that stuff in the country radio, you know, Ray Stevens. But then in the early 80s, it got real traditional. Randy Travis, Ricky Skaggs, The Judd, George Strait, you know, it just completely made a turn to country, or to bluegrass, actually, even style of country there. And then here come these five guys, like we said earlier, with these five part harmony things. And all I know is that the establishment wasn't crazy about it. You know, the people who vote for the awards really weren't crazy about it. And it took some time, you know, because everything was either earthy, you know, country, almost twangy. And if it wasn't, it was very earthy kind of country rock, like Alabama or Hank Jr. was doing. But it wasn't slick. And so all of a sudden, we bring this slick sound, I'll Still Be Loving You, you know, that's pretty. You know, why does it have to be wrong or right? Stuff that's really kind of on the poppy side of things. And it just didn't go over well, except for with radio. Gosh, radio accepted us with open arms. I mean, from day one, right out of the box, as we say. It was kind of amazing how... all of a sudden, when we released That Rock Won't Roll on our second Wheels album, we had like seven number ones in a row. Mm-hmm. And nobody could really figure it out, because it just was, you know, it really sounded way, way different than what was going on and what was being celebrated. But radio really supported us big time. They were great to us. And really, that's why we're, you know, still around for 37 years.
Yeah, like that's interesting to, because when I've been talking with other people, we've talked about how back then there was a little bit more diversity on the radio as far as sounds. There was a little bit more of a, as you mentioned, like the neo-traditional kind of stuff and like the twangier stuff, like the Dwight Yoakam, California, Bakersfield sound and like all these little different pockets. And I always like, I guess, you know, looking back for me, I always just think that like, oh, there's all this diversity and there's like, you know, that's what was so great about country radio at the time, because there was all these different kinds of sounds and different kind of acts going around. And it's interesting that you felt like, you know, a lot of the establishment was kind of looking at y'all as, I don't know, like maybe being more of like a rock band or like a soft rock band or,
exactly.
You know, in comparison to like a Journey or something like that, maybe.
Yeah, well, you know, because we really crossed over with I'll Still Be Loving You. And there wasn't much of that going on at the time because, you know, country music in Nashville was so traditional when we started. And so then they pushed it on the loaf, RCA did, and released I'll Still Be Loving You pop, and then went top 40. And then released, you know, to Adult Contemporary, and I don't know where it went. It went way high, top 10. And then What Wrong or Why It Had to Be Wrong or Right was released, you know, crossover, and New York Hold Her Tight was crossed over. And so, you know, that was something that was frowned upon, you know, at the time. But anyway, it's just very interesting. And how that all worked out. And again, radio, thank God for radio. But you know, what you was touching on was everything was different back then. Like I said, I mean, you know, not only just the voices, but the style of the record, you know, that, you know, like you say, the Bakersfield sound, you know, with Dwight, you know, and then the more Texas sound, with some of those guys, and then the Music Row sound with a more produced, but yet still country kind of sound, and the voices, you knew every single voice right off the bat, and all the music was different. Nothing, nobody sounded the same, and that was so refreshing.
Yeah, like that's something that like I think most people think of. When they look back, they can identify obviously the sound, but as you mentioned, like the voices were different too. It wasn't just like this homogenized middle voice. Like everyone had like these distinct, everyone had an accent, if you will, like you could tell where like people were from, not just by like how they sounded, but how they spoke and what they sung about in a lot of ways.
You're exactly right. You could. You almost could tell from the song they're singing and the way they sound and where they're from. I love that.
Yeah, I think like that's what like right now I feel like everyone just sings in this like generic Southern voice. And, you know, I don't know. Like I find we won't go down that road too far. But I just think that like, as you mentioned, like it's everyone just had like their distinct voices. And at the time, did you feel that like, you know, you had the backing of like the label as far as like them not trying to make you sound a certain way as far as like your vocals go? Or did you have like that freedom to, you know, sound like Larry Stewart from Kentucky?
They completely stayed away from us when we were making our records. Because they believed in Tim and Scott, and what they were hearing, they loved. So no, they didn't, you know, ask us to do anything. I mean, we would give them music, and they wouldn't say, you know what, that's too pop. You know, that's not that's not where country music is today. They said, oh man, I love that. That's different. We're going to put that out country and we're going to put it out crossover. You know, they were so, that they were, I think, ahead of the game in Nashville in the 80s. RCA was the best label and put stuff out there and it just jumped off the radio. And we were lucky to sign with them because there were no restrictions. We could do whatever we want. You know, we could go do a movie soundtrack, and make it do whatever we wanted, so or whatever. So we were very lucky. But, you know, we had good people around us and producers around us to make sure we kept it in the vein of, you know, a hit song for country radio. You know, that was first. We just got lucky, man. Just got some great songs. I think it was the songs, as much as anything, that we got lucky to find and got a couple of guys right. Because country music's all about the song. Well, it was back then anyway. It really was.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the things that I've talked about with a lot of people. Whenever you go back to this era, the song, like, obviously, you know, one of the big staples of country music is being sad about heartbreak or falling in love. And, you know, you have a song like The Bluest Eyes in Texas, as you mentioned, that's as pure as you can get. But at the time there was also room for songs about adult situations. You know, like you guys had some songs that were also on that end that were a little bit more serious, you know, like a song like Dancy's Dream is, you know, a serious song. It's not just about, you know, puppy love kind of stuff. What did, yeah. Was there
Fast
like
Living Train?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Was there
Fast Living Train is probably the deepest, you know, coolest. I mean, that song has so much depth and I know where it came from because it was written by Dave Loggins. He kind of wrote it, you know, about himself, but, that's just amazing songwriting to me.
Was there like were you guys like aware, was that something that you wanted to be part of like the fabric of Restless Heart to have more of these serious songs as well in the mix and be able to play them still on
radio,
obviously?
I think we just wanted to find some great songs that we could make sound like us, you know, as far as chord progressions, where we could put that harmony in there. Because the harmony was such a big deal. You know, there was a couple of songs here and there that we didn't, you know, make a humongous harmony, but not many. But as far as the seriousness, as compared to something tongue-in-cheek, that rock won't roll. There ain't nothing serious about that. And that was our first number one song. You know, why does it have to be wrong or right? It's just a really cool play on words, kind of a contemporary song written by a guy from California. You know, Fast Moving Train, As Serious As It Gets, I'll Still Be Loving You, a beautiful love song. You know, Blue Side in Texas the same way. So, you know, what are some of the other, you know, Big Dreams in a Small Town.
Mm-hmm.
It was really all over the board for us. Just as long as it was a great song, we'd sing about anything. At the time, I didn't really want to sing anything about drinking, you know, because country music was about cheating and drinking songs there for a long time. So I didn't really want to do that. So we didn't. But now they're back to singing about drinking songs. So what did I know?
Yeah. You mentioned how like you guys had that string of number one hits there. You know, that's something that like is, you can't necessarily take that for granted, obviously.
I tell you what, I don't even think we had a minute to think about it until later down the line. Cause, you know, we were on the road just doing what people told us to do, out on tour doing 130 or 40 shows, trying to record another album, trying to be here and there, trying to do business, trying to get along, bands are tough. It's like being married to four other guys. I don't think that we really sat around and had a cup of coffee and go, man, we're in the middle of a great streak, aren't we, boys? We didn't. We just held on for dear life until we came to the end of that streak, and then things kind of started falling apart, and then we kind of broke it off for a little while. And then that's when we realized, man, what a run, guys. I mean, can you believe, we had Grammy nominations, sang I'll Still Be Loving You on the Grammys with Michael Jackson and Stevie Wonder and Paul McCartney sitting 12 feet away from us in the front row. We started reminiscing about that kind of stuff and touring with people and doing certain shows with other people, doing American Music Awards with Whitney Houston and Van Halen. I mean, there were some really cool things that we were able to reminisce about, but it all was later. And, and when we got back together in the early 2000s and when we said, hey, guys, let's go out and see if anybody cares and go out and do some shows. And I mean, we really had a great run. And, well, we meant to just go do a few shows. And what's that? 18 years later, still doing shows.
Yeah. You mentioned a band is hard. It's these, as you said, it's like being married to four other guys. What's remarkable is you guys have had basically the same principal members the entire time.
Yeah. I was going to say, there's really only two bands that still have the same five original members, and that's Diamond, Rio, and Restless Heart, up until this year, been the last 30 years. So yeah, bands are hard, because you got, guys that fall out, people that don't get along, people that don't want to do it anymore. Bands break up, lead singers go out on their own, people retire. Just bands are tough. That's why rock and roll bands just do a tour and then they're off for a few years and they make a record and then they go tour again. Same country music is different. We tour all year. Country music is just totally different than pop and rock music. So, every year, here we go, it's March and it's time to get back on the bus and go tour till through November. And if we do a Christmas tour, then we'll go do Christmas tour in December. And then we'll take, 4 to 8 weeks off and hit it again. And so that's why I think it's amazing that country music bands, not artists, but bands, have been able to stay together for so long and make it happen and make it work, just because I guess it's more normal people in country music in those times than maybe other genres, and people kind of have to be on the ground better and get along better than some other people do.
Yeah. One of the things that a lot of other people have talked about has been how, whenever you get signed, whenever you become an artist and you're putting out records, all of your time starts getting divvied up. As you mentioned, you're in the studio, you're on tour, just constantly. You're in that whirlwind of just doing everything as far as recording, touring, press. There's not a lot of off time is what I guess my point.
Yeah.
Is that stressful at the time? Or is it does it go back to we don't really think about that until way after the fact?
It's way after the fact, but yeah, you feel the stress. I mean, I think anybody does. I mean, from the Oak Ridge Boys to Alabama to, all these other bands, that started when we started. Because it's different if you're a single artist and calling the shots with your manager and, tour management and, label and all that stuff. So getting along with three, four, or five people getting along, Diamond Rio, six people getting along. You just got to have really good people, a part of those bands. and kind of got their feet on the ground. And I really do. I do believe that, I hope this didn't come out wrong, but, you know, I just think country music folks just have a little better idea of normalcy than some of our rock and roll bands that we love so much just because it's crazy. I mean, the stories you hear, they're just crazy. So, you know, a lot of partying. And back in our days, back in the 90s, you know, people just didn't, you know, some did, but people just didn't party and go wild. I mean, for the most part, and a lot of my friends in country music, you know, by then you're married, you've got kids at home, and you know, you got to keep both feet on the ground and, you know, that kind of stuff. I don't know why our genre is different than others, but, you know, we just kind of do our shows and everything's a little bit more normal, I guess, than others. But to think that country music bands, you know, are still together for the most part, all the original members except for one here and there, you know, Sawyer Brown and Alabama, and, you know, just everybody kind of has hung in there over the last 30 years. I just think it's kind of cool.
Yeah. Like there's never a moment for Restless Heart where you guys all had your own bus because of the egos and that.
Oh no. No.
Pushing, yeah.
No, we didn't have our own private jet, our own separate jet. No, we didn't.
When was that you guys felt like you guys were on the, like, your A game? Was there like a certain tour that you guys felt like was that the quote unquote, like, I don't know, man, this is like the best version of that we're doing right now. Was there like any of those, I guess what I kind of call like the t-shirt tours, like, you know, where they got like all the tour dates on the back? Was there like any tour specifically that you kind of felt, man, this was a great run for us?
Yeah. I mean, as we look back and talked about it, that whole 80s thing, because, I mean, we went straight from touring with Alabama to touring with Hank Jr. to touring with Reba McEntire and the Judds at the same time. I mean, most young artists don't get to do that. I mean, it was just the explosion of country music into the arenas at that early to mid-80s. And we just got so lucky that so many of those artists want us to be on the show. It was like a 4 or 5 year run there to the, you know, up to 90. And then around 90, it started falling apart. We stopped, you know, the songs weren't going up the charts. Guys weren't getting along. We were worn out, you know, stressed out. And I left, and Greg Jennings, our guitar player, we were going to leave together, just step away for a minute. And last minute, Greg did, and I decided to go ahead and step away for a minute. So we all went and did something for another year or so, and then we shut it down and then got back together in the late 90s. And, you know, when everybody kind of let their jets cool and realized, you know, how lucky we were, and everybody kind of grew up and kind of got together and laughed. And like I said earlier, you know, our booking agent said, "Y'all are together? I'm coming over right now." So he wanted to see us all together. And we were going to go do a few shows and see if anybody cared, like I said. And 18 years later, still tour.
Mm-hmm. You know, those tours there with like Alabama and Reba, is there like downtime during those times where you're like, you're able to actually like hang out with those bands, like and actually get to know them in a way that's, whereas like their time just always.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We hung out. I mean, we love going on the road, 'cause that's when we got to see everybody. Yeah. you know, you come back home, you come back to Nashville and all the surrounding area where we all live, don't even see each other. So you got to go out on the road and do, you know, country thunders, and you got to do, you know, whatever the big festivals were where they have multiple acts, and you got to, you know, go to each other's bus and sit around and talk and have fun and just, you know, realize it was kind of a cool time. So there were those times, yeah. I mean, it wasn't like 24/7 just, you know, beating your head against the wall. But at some, you know, there were many, many points, too, that you did feel like that, and it was kind of miserable, and you know, you'd be gone for 7 weeks at a time, you know, and there was a lot of sacrifice there, but, you know, we were chasing our dream, and so there's give and take, and but yeah, there were some times where you got to, you know, talk to people, meet people, and hang out and watch their shows. That part was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Now, obviously, like you mentioned how, you know, you ended up putting out a couple of solo records, and how you wanted to have like that break right there. That 93 record you put out, Down the Road, I feel like that's like one of those hidden gems of the 90s. There was a few of these like little like records that were you obviously like there's like a top five hit on there and everything like that, but they're kind of like forgotten because like obviously Restless Heart is such a, as you mentioned, like people want to hear Restless Heart songs, you know, that, but that first solo record in particular, I feel is like such a hidden gem. What was it like, you know, cutting that record and kind of just, you know, as you mentioned, like with Restless Heart, there's five minds right there. What is it like recording a record where you're, you know, the one in charge?
Yeah. Well, it was a nice outlet for me. It was kind of fun, you know, label, you know, RCA and Columbia gave me an opportunity to, you know, do a solo record. And you know, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a completely, totally different, you know, experience. You know, five guys didn't have to agree on a song, just me and my producer. And, you know, those kinds of things, just kind of do something different, a little outlet. I didn't know, you know, All Right Already went to top five, and then after that kind of fell apart. There was like 27 major labels at that time. I don't know if you remember that. I mean, country music exploded, and there just wasn't room for all the labels to have a slot on country radio. And so that was just a time where, you know, so many of us, especially when you leave a band, you just get squashed. There's really not a chance. You know, Randy Owen did a record. You know, he didn't really get it played. You know, Brooks and Dunn, they've done solo records. And you know, they're just really, it's hard to get traction after that. And, but, you know, who knew? You know, you just make music because that's what we do. I'm not so sure a lot of thought goes into it. You just get up and put your boots on and go to work and do whatever the opportunity gives you. And so it was fun to do that. But when Restless Heart got back together and did the greatest hits thing, cut a couple of new songs, and we went out and toured with Vince for a year. And, you know, we got to kind of relive that moment, those moments of, you know, hitting the big stage in front of a sold out arena. And, you know, that's always fun. And hearing crowds sing your old hit songs back to you. Doesn't get much better than that.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And I was going to mention like on that record, that first solo record, you know, there's that a version of When I Close My Eyes that obviously ended up being a big hit for Kenny Chesney.
I think that was Susie Boggess, and we wanted that to be the second single. And I don't know why RCA, they put out I'll Cry Tomorrow, which was cool too, but I just felt like that song with that duet was a great follow-up to All Right Already. And so did our management, but they I voted us, of course, and of course, then it became a humongous hit for Kenny Chesney. But I know the writer of that song, so I was proud for him.
Yeah. I'm sure like that's one of those things where, you know, sliding doors, like there's in this alt universe where that was a big hit for you, because like that is such, I feel like that's such a great song. Like it's, you know, I'm not going to say I could sing it and it would have been a big hit, but you get what I'm saying. Like it's such a great song.
You cut out. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just saying like how that song right there is such a, like, I don't know. I'll cut this little bit out, but what I was saying was how, you know, that's such a great song that you had to have known it was going to be successful if it was put out in front of people.
Yeah. Great song, great emotion. You know, the voices together, great. That's the one we wanted, but you lose out sometimes to the big label.
Yeah, for sure. I want to close out. I'll get you out of here on this one right here. And, you know, obviously, as you've mentioned, like you got into songwriting you got a few cuts as the time went by. Was that something that you had always done from the very beginning, even back when you were at Belmont, was writing your own songs? And, or did you jump into it at a later time? What was, I guess, like as far as you writing songs and obviously getting them cut, like what was that process like?
Well, I only wrote at it. I didn't come to Nashville thinking I was a songwriter. I came to Nashville, you know, thinking that I could, and I had written some songs. But once I got in Restless Heart and had that opportunity, it automatically put me in rooms with Dave Logan, you know, and some of the greatest songwriters in the history of country music. And, you know, so to be honest with you, you know, I've written a lot of songs, but in a lot of cases, man, I was just sitting in the room watching them write. You know, it's like, oh man, I'm watching these people. They are the greatest. They have a craft like nobody I've ever seen, and so smart and talented. And so I was just taking that opportunity to learn. And I did. I learned a lot. I would consider myself more of a singer than a songwriter. But I am proud of many of the songs that I was able to write over the years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of times, like, you'll hear people critique about, or it'll be a criticism about how an artist is cutting other people's songs. But, like, there's a talent in knowing what's in a song, you know, and, like, knowing how to emote that and, like, get that emotion across. And I don't think, like, people dismiss it too easily, too quickly as, like, oh, they're just singing. No, there's like a, like that's part of it. That is like a huge part of the music industry as far as, or like just in art in general, is finding that emotion and connecting to that song. So.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, I always felt like, you know, I didn't care who wrote it. I didn't care, you know, if I wrote it or somebody in the band wrote it or somebody I don't even know wrote it. You know, we're in the business of public announcements or whatever, you know, it's like whatever you're saying just really needs to reach out and touch that person listening to it. And again, back in those days, the music world was just swarming with world-class songwriters. And I'm going, you know, why don't I want to sit around and try to write just an okay song? This is just me talking, you know, to write an okay song when, I mean, there's just amazing songwriters that are pouring their heart and souls out on music row. I mean, hey, I'd just soon sing one of those, because, man, I know that's a great song, and they're writing hits all over the place. If you remember back in those days, and just a great time, a great era for music and songwriting. And being an artist in country music.
No, I definitely agree with you. Larry, it's been really, really great talking with you today. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation and appreciate the phone call.
Okay, man. Thank you for your time. Enjoyed talking to you.
All right, that just about does it for this one. Huge thanks to Larry Stewart of Restless Heart for joining me on this one. And yeah, I'll see y'all next Wednesday for another episode here at the Neon Eon.